Well, take your Bibles this evening. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 and 3, mostly 3, but we're going to be in 2 first. I want to make a disclaimer, though. I did not, for those of you who have been leading to Bible study, I did not steal my wife's lesson, and neither did she steal mine. So we were talking a few weeks back briefly for just a couple minutes about the book of Daniel, and it got her brain going on it, and so did mine. So both of our lessons have been independently written. So any overlap is completely coincidental. Daniel chapter 2. Yeah, yeah. Daniel chapter 2, this I've also been thinking about this recently because I was teaching through this in our Bible class. And one of the helpful things about the book of Daniel is looking at the book quickly and as a whole. Because one of the things that we miss, because Daniel's so easy to teach independently, right? Because you have chapter 1, and it's its own little neat Sunday school lesson where you can start and you can finish and you can put it away. Daniel chapter 2, same thing. All of the stories of Daniel, the chapters make perfect sense because they're all their own thing. However, there's also a lot of connections between them all. And one of the ones that was really laid on my heart was how chapter 2 and 3 go together. So as I was looking through the Bible, thinking about Nebuchadnezzar, one obvious issue that Nebuchadnezzar struggled with was the problem of pride. Now, the interesting thing about word pride is that it comes from a lot of different words, both Greek and Hebrew. It can be translated into pride from a lot of different other words. What's interesting is those other words are sometimes translated positively, sometimes majesty or splendor or exaltation or even height. All those are good things that maybe God has gifted somebody with. But of course, those words are often sometimes translated negatively, like arrogance and boasting. But more often than not, those words are translated as pride. Now, why can it have a negative and a positive? Because the fact is, when we have been lifted up even legitimately, given majesty or splendor or majesty or goodness or exaltation, it's almost impossible for the human heart to take good things that God gives to them without lifting up ourselves. It's a perennial issue that we have when we're given talent or we're given ability or we're given opportunity or we're given power. We take the things that God gives to us and we use them to focus on ourselves. And it seems to be almost impossible to avoid pride especially when you have all of them. At least that's what the experience tends to be for us. Nebuchadnezzar is a great example of that. It's interesting to know Nebuchadnezzar's history. Nebuchadnezzar is not the spoiled brat who inherited the kingdom from his dad. That's not what happened. See, a few decades before the book of Daniel is written, Babylon is just its own little city-state way far down the Tigris and Euphrates. It was an old big empire, but that had long been the past. The Assyrian Empire was in charge, and they were oppressing a lot of people. Now, they're pretty far away. Babylon's pretty far away from Assyria. And a guy named Nabopolassar, he was a leader in the area, and he thought, you know what? I think this is the time, if we rise up, we can push the Assyrians out of our city and get them out of our hair. Well, just leave us alone. And so he was successful at doing that. He gathered the people together, and he pushed them out of town, and it worked very well. And it worked so well that he kept pushing them. And he kept pushing them. And then the Median Empire up north saw what was going on, and they said, we want on in this too, because the Assyrians are horrible people. So they got together with Babylon, and they pushed him back further and further. In 612 BC, they attacked Nineveh and completely sacked it, destroyed it. The Assyrians got pushed back farther and farther. Their kingdom was smaller and smaller, and they had gotten all the way to the city of Carchemish. The Egypt came up to help Assyria, but the Babylonians and the Medians had too much power. And so Nabopolassar and his son, Nebuchadnezzar, had fought them all the way back to their last major city, and the Assyrians were defeated. When they defeated the Assyrians at Carchemish in 605 BC, Babylon really emerged as the reigning power in the world. And that year, Nabopolassar dies. And the heir apparent is his son, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, therefore, is a young king who is responsible for taking the kingdom. He did take it. And now he is the most powerful man in the world. And so briefly, he goes home in 606 BC or 604 BC, but not before he goes down to Jerusalem in 605 BC. And he takes all the princes and all the heirs to the kingdom and to the throne and all the royal family, and he takes a bunch of them back with him, including Daniel and his three friends. And so we're in Daniel chapter 2. And the Bible says this, and this is very significant because I want you to think about how Nebuchadnezzar's thinking. Verse number 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him. Now, what I want you to notice in this story, Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar is in his second year. Second. This is 604 BC. He has just finished conquering the Assyrian Empire at Carchemish. He has just finished taking a group of captives back home, and he has just gotten there, looking forward to what he's going to do in the future. He is not in charge of all of the world. Not at this point. We know that from both history, and we know that from all the prophecies in Jeremiah, prophesying of all of the cities and nations that are going to fall later. Nebuchadnezzar does not have control of Israel. He does not have control of Tyre and Zidon. He doesn't have control of Syria or Damascus. He doesn't have control of Elam. He doesn't have control of Kedar or Hazor. He doesn't have control of Edom or Moab or Ammon or Egypt or Lydia. None of those places. And we know that because the Bible tells us that. All of these places are getting together, trying to figure out what they can do to push Babylon out. Meanwhile, Nebuchadnezzar's back home thinking what he's going to do in the future. So what are you thinking Nebuchadnezzar's thinking? Right now he has a moment of stability, but the leader just died. There's all these people who are afraid. He doesn't have control of the whole world at this moment. So he's wondering how long his nation is going to last, how long his power is going to last. The Median Empire just helped him defeat them. They only help them for their own sake. Who knows how long they're going to be loyal? They're just sitting to the north. Am I going to be secure in the future? Is this nation and is this country that my dad and I built, is it going to last? And he has a dream. Dreams are very important back then. God often spoke in dreams because they interpreted them as coming from the gods. So God gave him a dream of a statue in Daniel chapter 2. He sees a statue made of a lot of different, it's a person, and there's a lot of different metals on the statue. The head is made of gold, the arms and the chest are made of silver, the stomach and the thighs are made of brass, their feet are of iron, and the legs are of iron, and their feet are of iron and clay. A rock made without hands comes and destroys the feet and the rest of the statue, and Nebuchadnezzar wakes up. He's troubled. It's obvious the dream means something. He asks all of his wise men and then all the astrologers to interpret the dream, but also tell him what his dream was so he can be secure that he knows exactly what this interpretation is. He's wondering what the gods are trying to communicate to him about all the uncertainty that he has about the future of his kingdom. Daniel, of course, we know the story. He asks for a couple days to pray and ask God for help to interpret the dream. And he comes, and God gives him the interpretation, and this is the interpretation that Daniel gives. Look down to verse number 36. Daniel gives him the interpretation. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof. He's already explained it. I already explained it. We'll move on. This is the interpretation. Verse 37. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. For the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. After this shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over the earth. He goes on, he describes the iron, he describes the clay, and he describes their rise to power. Verse 44. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. The king answered unto Daniel and said, Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret. So Nebuchadnezzar learns two things on this day. One, his kingdom will be secure and it will be great. He just got it. They just finished fighting the last world power. That is far from obvious at this point. But now he knows that it will be great. It will be the first among the greats. But he also knows it will not last forever. And that God's kingdom will replace it. Imagine having a dream, though, like this. Vividly stamped, burned onto your memory. For the rest of his life, he would see this tower, this towering image of all these different metals. And every time he would imagine this image, he would see the head of gold. And he would think, God says, that is me. But imagine also, burned into your brain, you continue to have this picture of that same image crumbling and that head of gold falling to the ground and being replaced. But as humans are, we tend to only think about what's convenient for us. He was told that he would be great, and he was told that he would be replaced, but guess which part he remembered the most. Chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So the next thing you see him doing in this book, and this is not by accident, is him building a giant statue. But it's only made of one metal, gold. Now, Daniel chapter 3 is an interesting thing. The plain of Dura, it's very difficult to know where that is. A lot of people believe it is 6 miles south of Babylon. It matches an ancient word that would have been called Dura. Also, there is a pedestal that has been uncovered there that quite possibly could be this. It's hard to say. But there's a lot of uncertainty about this chapter. There's a lot of unanswered questions that we have. The first and the biggest one is that we actually don't know when this story took place, which is super frustrating because it doesn't say. Chapter 2, in the second year of his reign. Chapter 3, he set up a statue. When was that? Was it at the very beginning? Was it at the very end? 40-some years later when he was finished being king? What's interesting is, though, that the Greek translation of the Old Testament actually makes a note that it was in his 18th year. And the reason why that would be significant is 18 years after Nebuchadnezzar became king. You know all those places I said he wasn't in charge of yet? Moab, Ammon, Israel, Zion, Tyre, Syria. He had conquered all of that during that time. So he had come home probably about 18 years later and came to the conclusion that I am king of the world now. My country is secure. I truly am the head of gold. And so I tend to lean that direction. But he does build it at some point. The other big uncertain question is, Daniel's not in this story at all, which is just very obvious. And nobody really knows exactly what to do with it. Where is Daniel? Is he away on some important mission? Is he back at the city guarding or doing the affairs of the city? Verse 49 of the previous chapter says that that's where he was. He sat at the gate of the city. So if all the important people are out here, I guess somebody's got to watch home base. So that could be possible. Some people have purported that Nebuchadnezzar did something while Daniel was away because he was embarrassed to do it while Daniel was present, since he was the interpreter of the dream in the last chapter. We don't know. But the third thing that we don't know is actually what the image is. This whole chapter is about commanding all the people to worship, and we don't even know what the image is. If you actually look at the dimension, it says that it's 60 cubits, so that's 60 cubits, which would be 90 feet, and 6 cubits wide. That's 9 feet wide. Imagine a 90-foot building, and it's this wide across. That's very, very short. So there's a lot of different, some people think more like a totem pole, possibly an obelisk, which would be very possible. Washington Monument's an obelisk, it's one of those. Some people think that it's a person standing on the top of a pedestal. But we don't know. It doesn't say. We also don't know what it represents. Does it represent Babylon? Does it represent Nebuchadnezzar? Does it represent one of the gods that they worship? It doesn't say. And so since all of those are striking omissions, then we have to look at what it does say. It tells us two major things about it. Besides its big size, it tells us it's made all of gold. It tells us that. And that Nebuchadnezzar set it up. In fact, that is one of the most repeated phrases of this entire story, that this image he set up. Now remember, chapter 2, he dreams a dream of all the images, this image of all these metals that represent all these kingdoms. He did not set that up. God set those up. But then Nebuchadnezzar had an opportunity to make his own image, and he set it up. I want you to see it. I want you to see it show up over and over again. Look at verse 2. So he sent to gather all the important people to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And so, verse 3, they were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they were told in verse number 5 that when they hear all the music, that you should fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Verse 7, so at the time when the people heard all the music, they fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Verse 12. But there were certain Jews who did not bow down, and they served not the gods or worshiped the image which thou hast set up. In verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar calls them and he speaks to them. Is it true that you don't serve my gods nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Verse 15. So he tells them, I'll give you another chance. Be ready when you hear all the music that you fall down and worship the image which I made. Verse 18, but they said, we're not careful to answer you. We can't worship your image. We will not serve thy gods or worship the golden image which thou hast set up. So what do we know? All the things he doesn't tell us in this chapter, all the questions that we have that we will not get answers to, what he makes sure that we know is this image that is all of gold, he set up for himself. Pride is taking the life that we have been given, for good or for bad, and making life about myself rather than him. So I'm going to give you a few statements tonight that we see in this chapter about pride. I think it'll be helpful for us. Number one, I decided to say my points. I know. I was like, I'm going to do one of those where I don't say any of my outline, but I'm so outline-ish, I couldn't really do that. Number one, being prominent does not make you preeminent. Being prominent does not make you preeminent. Here's the struggle for Nebuchadnezzar. It is true that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. God told him that. You are the first among the greats of the kingdom. That was true. He was the most powerful man in the world. He did conquer Assyria. He was very well respected. He was a great warrior, and he was a great builder. He was all those things. But rather than simply accepting that God had given him a place in his world, he decided to make the world about him. Instead of just accepting that he's part of the image, he decided to say that the whole image should be about him. If God is using your whole life to work his plan, it does not mean that God's plan is all about you. But we have such a proclivity to take what God has made us and then make it all about ourselves. And that's why the Bible, in addition to talking about the things that he does in our life, also makes sure that it emphasizes our limitations to cut us back to size. I was reminded of the book of Ecclesiastes. We see the book of Ecclesiastes quite frequently as being sad or depressing, but it's just reality. The reason that we often get sad or depressed about the book of Ecclesiastes is because we don't like reality. In the first chapter of the book, if you want to turn there, you can. I'm not going to be in there super long. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse number 3, it says this: "What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever." You open the book, you're two verses in, and he says, just so you know, you're going to die. The world's going to go on without you. Well, that's not very nice, but it's true, though. I am not the sustainer of life on this world. I'm not. I can have a place, I can have a position, I can have power, I can have prominence. But that doesn't mean the world needs me to function. He goes on, verse number 9. "The thing that hath been is that which shall be. That which is under the sun is that which shall be done. There's no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, ah, this is new? It's been already of old time, which was before us. There's no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are come with those that shall come after." He says, a lot of times we think that we are the innovators of the world and the world needed us in order to make it this way. He says, you're going to forget what you did. And the people that do things in the future are going to forget that too. We're not the creator of all good things. We're also not the teacher of truth. Look at verse number 17. "I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow." I'm not the teacher of truth. I'm not the sustainer of life. I'm the creator of all good things. The only reason we find passages like this frustrating is because we have a desperate need to be preeminent. Maybe God has given you a great place and a prominent position. Maybe that is true. We don't have to deny that that's true in order to have humility. What we have to deny is that it's all about us. Maybe God has given you a position and a place as well, but just because you're a piece of the statue doesn't mean that you're the whole statue. That's why the book of Colossians says this: "He is the head of the body, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence." But the issue is, we want to have the preeminence. Remember what it says in 3 John 9, talking about Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them? And what we're doing is we're going around building our own statues made all of our own image. And it's not all about us. It's not about who we are. And it's not about what God has done in us. It's about his kingdom, even if we are a part of it. Just because you're prominent doesn't make you preeminent. Number two, what you have received. And God can just as easily take it away. So, he is the head of gold. He is. He is the first among the greats. But go back. Remember, I started here. Go back to chapter 2, verse 37. He starts his interpretation of the passage. He says, "What is your dream about?" He begins by saying, verse 37, chapter 2, "Thou, O king, art a king of kings." He was. He was the king over other kings. "For God, for the God of heaven, hath given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." He gave him all of that. So he was the head of gold, because God gave it to him. Those two things were true. He didn't have to deny the position that he had. He just had to recognize where it came from. And Nebuchadnezzar would not learn that lesson. He didn't in chapter 3. Well, he gave an acknowledgement at the end of the chapter to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But then what happens in chapter 4? He has a dream. There's a great tree. that covers the whole earth, and all the creatures and the birds of the earth rest underneath the shadows of its branches. And then it's cut down. And he wakes up. What's the dream about? Calls Daniel. Daniel says, this dream is for your enemies, but it can be avoided. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the great tree. You are in charge of the whole earth. And all the people of the earth rest under the shadows of your branches. But if you do not realize where it comes from and you take all of the credit, you will be cut down. 1 year later, he goes onto his terrace, basking in all the glory that he had made. And he becomes a beast of the field. He becomes nothing. He becomes below mankind till he realizes that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will, even the basest of us. The thing is, we don't have to deny what God has given to us. We don't know how to be humble. We think the only way to be humble is to act like God hasn't given us something. Well, no, that's not true. Well, maybe it is true. But what he says in 1 Corinthians, I want you to listen to this. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, he says this. He says, you might learn in us not to think of men above that which is written, that no one of you be puffed up for one against another. For who maketh thee to differ from another? And what hast thou that thou didst not receive? So if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hast not received it? The whole conversation in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 about division and how there's the body of Christ, that we need to recognize that we all need each other and one cannot say to the other, I don't need you, is a whole conversation that begins talking about spiritual gifts. Gifts. We take what God gifts to us and use it as a way to elevate ourselves. But what have we that we did not receive? And God can just as easily take it away. Brother Conley, he spoke on Thursday, and he spoke very well for himself. And so the common way to be humble is like, hey, you spoke really well. No, I didn't. Well, no, he did. And that's fine. But he received that. Ruthie sings very well. She does. Oh, no, it wasn't good. No, it was. It was a great song. But you received that. Sam's very good with people, way better with people than I am. But you received that. Businessman, you are good with numbers. You are good with administration. But you received that. Community leader, you are good at leading and guiding people to a goal. That's fine. But you received that. And the fact is, our problem is not that we take what God gives to us, is that we make it preeminent and then make it the image that everyone should bow down and worship. I think a good test is the fact that a bunch of you in here are thinking, why didn't he call out my talent? I was just waiting for the next one. But it's not about you. And it's not about me. And whatever it is that you're thinking of that I should have mentioned, you received it. And the moment that somebody says, hey, great message, Nathan, and I go, well, you know, thanks, is the moment that I'm in danger of having my tree cut down. Whatever we have, we've been given. And God can just as easily take it away. And sometimes he will, to remind us where it comes from. Number three. The last part, so just a few notes, I think. Number three, when you're concerned about your status, you tend to only care about those who aid you and not those who cannot. So what's interesting is who he invites. Long list of people. Princes, governors, and captains. Most of my commentators believed that that was a hierarchy of groups. The princes being the one who was in charge of like a whole nation underneath the Empire of Babylon. The governors being underneath them, and the captains being underneath them, maybe. They have judges who are the law executors, and you have treasurers and counselors and sheriffs, everybody that has any value, all the fancy people. True mark of self-centeredness is that you only care about people who can somehow lift you up. And the reason I thought about that is because Jesus does the exact opposite in his ministry, doesn't he? The Son of God comes to this earth, and there's plenty of fancy people to surround himself with. And he finds the real radical outcasts, publicans, zealots, the people that nobody wants to associate with because they're on the far ends of the spectrum, Nazarenes and Galilean fishermen. These are his people. And what's so ironic about all of these outcasts and all of these despised people is that they're used to being looked down on. But they get around the Messiah and have a conversation about who is the greatest and spend their time thinking about their part in God's kingdom. They are going to be part of God's kingdom, but who's going to sit on his right hand or at his left? They are the head of gold in what God is doing. But there they were, building their own individual statue. And you see that by how they react to other people, don't you? Jesus is walking down, and obviously, because Jesus is important, he only wants to spend time with important people. And children come by. And they do not suffer them to speak to Jesus, because certainly regular people aren't worth his time. You know why they thought that way? Because that's what they would have done if they were Jesus. And so Jesus says, suffer the little children to come to me, because of such is the kingdom of heaven. He says, he reminds them, Peter, James, John, Nathan, he says, you are part of my kingdom, but my kingdom is completely made up of little children. There aren't big shots in my kingdom. So that little child is just as important. A good measure of our pride is who we have time for. We all have time for the little babies because they're cute, right? And they say our name and then we're like, oh, he knows me. But what about the elementary school kid? You know, he's out of the cute stage, so. And then there's the other kid that's below him. You know, the next sibling just got born, so he's old news. And he can't do anything because he's not older. You can't have him lift stuff and help you with anything. So he's just there, growing. He's just a person. He doesn't aid you in any way. Do we have time for them? Jesus did. Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't. Only time he is for princes and governors. That's why the book of James tells us that we are partial in and of ourselves, and we become judges of evil thoughts when we start to measure people. He says, so what happens is you're going to have church, and you're going to have a guy come in the back with gay clothing, and you say, hey, sit here in a good place. But then you have somebody who's not that way. Sit in the back. Be under my footstool. He says, that's not what Christ does. That's not what spiritual maturity looks like. And that's exactly the opposite of what you're seeing those who are humble in the Bible doing. Remember David in 2 Samuel 9? When he becomes king and he becomes prominent and his whole kingdom is established, he's sitting in Jerusalem, he's made all of his borders quiet. He asks, who amongst the house of Saul, who has no power, no influence, who can he be kind to? And the only one that he gets reported of is a guy who is lame in his feet. So not only is it an outcast family that can't add prestige to David, he's not even physically capable of doing anything around the house. And he says to Mephibosheth, come and sit at my table every day, just to show kindness. When everything is about us, we begin to love people only for what they can do for me. And ultimately, to love only the people who can do something for me is truly to love myself. Number four, self-promotion is anti-Christ. It's anti-Christ. A couple of striking similarities, having gone through the book of Revelation just recently, that I noticed in this chapter. And I won't go back and read it all. But one thing that he says is that he demands that all people and nations and languages come down and worship before this image. And it immediately reminded myself of the passages in the book of Revelation where all people and nations and languages and tongues fall down before Christ on his throne. That's where all worship is due, but here Nebuchadnezzar wants all that worship for himself. But then what does he do in this chapter? He sets up an image and demands loyalty to his kingdom and to himself that all should bow down and worship it. Well, that's exactly what the Antichrist does in Revelation chapter 13. He sets up an image and demands that everybody fall down and worship it. And that's what the great harlot that rides the beast in Revelation chapter 17, who represents Babylon, does. And that spirit is over many waters, which is all the people and nations and languages and multitudes of the earth. The thing is, that self-promoting, image-making heart is in all of us, in every broken system in this world. It's not just in Nebuchadnezzar, it's in everybody who is given some gift by God. We tend to want to promote ourselves and want everybody to demand allegiance and recognition of us. And we think about the horrible, destructive, life-sucking policies of the Antichrist kingdom, but it all begins in Babylon. And Babylon is in all of us, as we all erect images made entirely of what we represent. This is when we get mad, when other people don't notice us. Why does it matter? I know it's nice when people say, hey, good job, I saw what you did, great. But why is it that when we say, hey, I'm a part of it, then we demand that everybody else recognize it? And then we start to get mad at the people who don't, because they were disloyal to us. In spite of the fact that they're loyal to God's kingdom, they're still serving the Lord, they're still doing what they're supposed to be doing, but they didn't see my image, so we hold them accountable. That's what the Antichrist does in Revelation. That's what Nebuchadnezzar does. And for us to do the same thing is to put ourselves in very bad company. Number five, you will be forced to reckon with Christ's position one way or another. You will be forced to reckon with Christ's position one way or another. Nebuchadnezzar is forced to exercise his great independence from God that he has, but then God takes that opportunity to show up. He throws Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the burning fiery furnace that he's heated seven times hotter, as if for some reason that was going to make them die more. But just to prove the point, he throws them in, and he peers in, and he sees a fourth walking around with them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come out, not burned, not even smelling like smoke. And it says, Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants and trusted in him and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve or worship any god except their own God. Nebuchadnezzar pulled up his own image, but the fact is he's going to have to reckon with the fact that he is not what everything is all about, one way or another. And it's either when he promotes it beforehand or when he's humiliated afterwards, but every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, whether we like it or not. God may very well have to severely humble us before we realize that the position and the prominence and the power and the ability that we were given was for his glory and not our own. And if we never get that, we will still have to reckon with it sooner or later. And it might be to our embarrassment instead of our credit. And that takes me to my last point, which I'll mention briefly. History will laugh at our attempts to make ourselves great. History will laugh at our attempts to make ourselves great. See, in the moment, Nebuchadnezzar was the strongest man in the world, so it just made sense. Now, there's an interesting note, though. When I began to study this passage, it's not agreed upon when this chapter took place. It's also not agreed upon when this chapter was written. Some liberal theologians have dated Daniel all the way to the intertestament period. Usually, that's simply because Daniel gives a lot of prophecies in the book of Daniel, and they thought, well, certainly he couldn't have known that, so he must have written it after the fact. well, that's just a denial of miracles, and that's a different conversation. However, assuming this was written by Daniel, it's not agreed upon when Daniel himself wrote it down. Did he go home right after this took place and write down the story? We don't know. But one interesting thing that we note is that in the list of all the officials, the princes and governors and captains, one thing that's interesting about this section of Daniel, have you ever heard anybody say what languages the Bible is written in? They say it's Greek and Hebrew and a little bit of Aramaic. They always do a little bit of Aramaic. Not a whole lot, just a little bit. Well, the little bit of Aramaic is mostly in the book of Daniel, because Daniel 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are all written in Aramaic, not Hebrew. And what's interesting is that raises a lot of questions about what some of these words really, really, really mean. And that's because a lot of times it's like in a list of officials or of instruments, and sometimes it's not extremely obvious what that Aramaic word meant. And one conversation we have is about all the list of officials. You have princes, and you have governors, and you have captains, you have treasurers, you have sheriffs. And one thing that almost every single commentator that I read noted was that some of these words that he uses are oddly Persian. They're not Babylonian words. So he gives a long list of all the officials he invited, and four of the officials he mentions are Persian words, not Babylonian words. Well, that's an odd thing to do, to talk about all Babylonian government official and use Persian governmental words. And the reason why he might have done that is if he did not write it during the time of Babylon's reign, but during the time of Persia's reign. Because we all know, a couple chapters later, Daniel is still alive and well and very prominent when Persian is very much in charge of the world. Now, if that's true or if it's not, I think it's an interesting thing to consider that the great irony of this passage and Nebuchadnezzar raising an image to himself is that quite possibly the first time the story was written down was after Babylon was very much long gone and had no power at all. And so here we see Nebuchadnezzar talking about how great and how permanent and how awesome his kingdom is, and the first time people are reading this story is quite possibly after Nebuchadnezzar is old news and Babylon is not in control of the world. And the golden head is gone and been very much replaced by the silver arms and the silver chest. Whether that's true or not, it still is true that we read the story knowing that Babylon was very much replaced by Persia. It was very much replaced by Greece. It was very much replaced by Rome. And the thing is, we look back on it and we see how great he really thought that he was. But Babylon is just a city living in the sand of Iraq somewhere. And we think we might know where the image used to be, maybe. That's what it's become. The thing is, we think we are so great because we're living now and we can only see this part of what God's doing in this world. And we are everything that we think about. But the problem is, when we look back on us, we are going to be embarrassed about how prominent we tried to make ourselves to be. One interesting character, and I'll be done, that we laugh at is in the book of Judges. His name is Abimelech. Gideon in Judges 6, 7, and 8, he had the opportunity to become king over all of Israel. He delivered the people from the Midianites, and all the people thought, wow, great, let's make him in charge. And Gideon said, no, I'm not going to be in charge. There was a little bit of other stuff with Gideon as well, but he denied the kingdom. Well, he dies. He has all these children, 70. And, yeah, well, that's a different message for another time. And one of his sons' name is Abimelech. And he thought, well, if Gideon's not going to be king, and they still respect our family, I'll take the position if he doesn't want it. Gideon's gone. Abimelech raises up and he says, I'll be king. He kills all of his brothers except for one who escapes so that everyone can look to him for prominence. He self-declares himself king of Israel. His brother that he didn't kill shows up and tells a parable to the people. It's a funny parable. I encourage you to go back and read it. He says, so the trees wanted a king over them. They asked the olive tree, will you be a king? And he says, no, I won't leave my fatness to be king over you. And so they ask the fig tree, will you be king over us? And he says, no, I'm not going to leave my sweetness to be king over you. By the way, if you want to leave your fatness, you have to leave your sweetness. I know, that was cheap, wasn't it? All right. So he asks the vine, will you be king over you? He says, I'm not going to leave my wine to be king over you. So the trees asked the bramble bush to be king. The bramble bush was happy to be king over them. And the bramble bush says to the trees, come and rest under the shadow of my branches. And Abimelech's brother says this to this small city who has declared Abimelech king over him, that this is the king that they have chosen. The rest of the chapter is embarrassing to Abimelech. He declares himself king over Israel. He's really only ruler over a small section that actually recognizes that he's even around. And the whole thing turns out where all of the cities, the few cities that were loyal to him, all turn on him and on each other, and he ends up losing his kingdom by it really just self-imploding, and they assassinate him by throwing something out of a tower on top of him. And that is his legacy, and it's penned in the Bible, and we all laugh at him. His feeble attempt to make himself great, build his own kingdom, and for everybody to rest under the shadow of his feeble branches. But his tree was cut down. And so will ours be. It's not that God has not made us great or prominent or given us a gift. Maybe he has. Maybe he has given you an ability. Maybe he has given you a position. Humility doesn't deny what God has given to us. Humility just doesn't erect our own image and demand loyalty from everybody around us. Because when we do that, we're opposing everything that God's trying to do, putting ourselves on the opposite side of what he's attempting to do in this world. And we might end up getting cut down. So tear down the image that you have set up.